We don't really let go of our dead. I mean, there is this kind of fiction, really, that has been perpetrated that you go through the stages of grief and that somehow you let go and your relationship to the dead is gone. In reality, that never happens because the dead haunt us, you know. They're part of our memories, they're part of our psyche, they're part of the construction of our very understanding of ourself and how we've lived. So they're always there. And so I think that it's really important to acknowledge that we want to continue a relationship with the dead, and social media platforms enable us to do that and to have conversations with them.
We're getting communication from people that we don't usually get communication from. We're getting representations that we haven't gotten before, and we're getting them with a kind of immediacy that we haven't gotten before.
Hello, welcome to Future Tense and to part two of our look at the power of the image. Today, witnessing, death and memory. I'm Anthony Fennell. Social media is still a very recent phenomenon, but it's old enough now that it's had to incorporate the reality of death. Those who have died sometimes have their online sites turned into memorials and tributes, while for those who are dying, a social media account can offer a last avenue for goodbye to family, friends and acquaintances. Margaret Gibson is a sociologist at Griffith University, and she's conducted extensive research into the nature of death in the online world.
I think online mourning and memorial culture has really enabled people to traverse and move beyond, you know, aspects of their cultural background if they wish to move beyond those, and particularly perhaps much more suppressed forms of cultural attitudes to mourning and how to do that appropriately and with dignity. So certainly the Anglo-Saxon person who may feel quite constrained about how long they're able to mourn in front of other people can move beyond, you know, rigid time frames that, you know, perhaps after 6 months you start to withdraw within yourself, withdraw from others and internalise your mourning and make it a kind of secret relationship that you have with yourself. So I think that's a really important transition that's happened through online culture and digital media, that it's really enabled people to go beyond the constraints of what's considered to be appropriate mourning at appropriate times and over what period of time.
And in some circumstances, online mourning allows people to continue a conversation in a way with the person who has departed.
I guess the interesting thing is that on platforms such as Facebook, if the deceased have a memorial page or if their page is still active and alive, people will post things and say, hey, you would be surprised what happened to me today. Or do you remember so-and-so? And there's lots of research that shows this kind of ongoing conversation that people who miss loved friends or family will do on social media. And of course, it's a one-way conversation. But the fact that we imagine that the dead can somehow listen to us and are still there in our lives, I think is a really important thing to keep in mind.
And what should we make of the fact that those would be considered very, very private moments, very private conversations, and yet they play out in the modern online world? They play out in a very public space, don't they?
I think that is a really interesting thing, and some people feel uncomfortable witnessing these kind of public acts of what they consider to be, you know, deeply personal and private forms of grief and emotional loss. But I think what it also does is that it exposes the reality that in the psychology of mourning, we are always missing those loved ones. The fact that it has had to be privatized and so secret for many people, you know, that limiting factor creates the illusion that somehow people have forgotten their dead. If you're not hearing about them anymore, it can create the illusion that they're gone and forgotten. So I think social media actually says no. You know, the reality is that this was once internalized and now we are showing it in public and open ways. We're exposing it, you know, to the witnessing of others and also to share as a reality, you know, that other people also know about. I think we now have to accept that a lot of our grief culture is primarily in the digital space, that it's no longer like the supplementary space for ritual that is taking place elsewhere. It is primary ritual, along with a whole lot of other rituals, such as the funeral or the grave and the setting of the gravestone. So we have to give it equal value because it's here to stay. And I think increasingly through the range of platforms that people have as part of their daily life, their biography is online and it's shared with others and it's interconnected so thoroughly with the lives of other people that we have to take seriously. These personal histories and social histories of mourning, along with our more kind of physically based rituals, you know, in churches or places of worship and in cemeteries.
Yes, I got the job, Keza. You would have been proud of me.
Hey, Dad. Kicked a ball with my son in that park you used to take me to when I was his age. Miss you, Dad.
I still think of you every time I hear that stupid song. It's like you're just about to come through the door.
I don't think we can see this as, you know, distinctly different in a sense from the distortions of memory that we might have had with legacy media.
Dr. Anna Reading from King's College London.
I think all mediations of memory, in a sense, are distortions. And all mediations of memory, to some extent, are going to be curated or dominated by those who have more power and more voice. You know, what might be different with this is the extent to which, actually, people who have less voice, who are on more of the kind of marginality of memory, are able to mobilise. But to some extent, you know, it's all a kind of mediation. It's a distortion in that regard.
We understand that the death of somebody will affect some people more than others. And that there is, you know, we have this idea of a kind of natural hierarchy, I suppose, based on kinship. You know, so immediate family are the ones that are most deeply embedded in the life of the person that has died. And there's a great deal of love and attachment to that person. And I think we have to respect the idea that there are certainly hierarchies of grief. But I think we have to think more carefully about those hierarchies of grief and not always assume that it will be next of kin that should make decisions, particularly about social media accounts and their ongoing status. You know, whether they'll be kept open, whether they'll be memorialised, or whether they will in fact be deleted. So if, you know, someone who's died has had very important and significant relationships with their friends over a long period of time on social media, and say their next of kin is their parent or parents, who have not been, you know, particularly participatory in that space, then I'm not sure that it is the parent or parents who should make the decision about the fate of that social media account. I think there should be consultation with those relationships that are heavily invested and obvious, you know, obviously present in that social media space. Because, you know, it has been shown in research that if a social media account is deleted and there's a whole history of stories and shared lives that have happened in that space, then there's a real sense of another loss that's taken place. Not only have you lost your good friend, but you've lost that whole kind of history of co-creation of biography with that person. So I think we have to think very carefully about this in terms of hierarchies of grief. It's not simple, and it's very distributed in complex ways, and it's differentiated in terms of where the different levels of investment might be and attachment to certain kinds of accounts.
In May 2014, the European Court of Justice ruled that internet users have the, quote, right to be forgotten. They ordered Google to remove undesirable links to personal data that is inaccurate, inadequate, irrelevant, or excessive.
One of the things about death and legacy, which is going to be very, I think, controversial and important, is what do people remember about you?
Jason Schultz, professor of law at New York University.
So this tension between the right to be forgotten and what we want to be remembered is going to come out more and more, I think, as people die. Certain families and other people who care about a legacy will want to kind of scrub the bad stuff. Whereas archivists, journalists, and other people who might want to record history might want to preserve the good and the bad. And I think the law and the technology companies are going to have to struggle with how to balance those two instincts. So it's not just criminal, but it's even reputational embarrassment. Say you did a funny video that, you know, is one of the things you're known for on the internet, but after you pass away, out of respect or some other motive, the people in your family decide they don't want that to be part of your history anymore. And they might want Wikipedia or Google to not link to that anymore when your name comes up. On the other hand, maybe it's an important part of what happened on the internet or in your life, and someone wants to tell that story. I kind of think of it in the same way as there'll be an authorized or an unauthorized biography. And sometimes the unauthorized biography is important. It tells a lot of important facts about someone's life and history and who they were that maybe the people who are in charge of their legacy don't want the world to know, but need to know. On the other times, it's crass and frivolous and sort of unnecessary. So it's hard to know how to strike the balance, but it's going to come up over and over online when we have people die.
Where are we at then with that idea of a right to be forgotten?
So right now, the right to be forgotten is really something that's in the European Union, that the cases and courts there are working out. But there's a lot of conversation all over the world, in the United States and in other countries as well, about how much of a right to be forgotten we all should have. And one of the implications of that is that if we have a different right in each country, then the way you're remembered in each country might be different. In one country, they might tell the whole story, everything, good and bad and ugly. In another country, they might erase some of it and only tell part of the story. So what your legacy is might depend on where someone is searching from. Part of the reason the EU has this right is because they're trying to think about dignity on the internet. And they're trying to think about allowing people to have fresh starts and to put the past behind them. And it's part of what we think about, I think, when someone dies. We try to remember the best of them, what they contributed, what they gave, and not necessarily the uglier parts of their history. And I think that's part of what people want when they think about this right to be forgotten. They want a way to have a fresh start or a future. But with history and remembering the facts of someone's life, it's a difficult decision about what we want to remember and what we want to forget.
This is Kesa again coming at you with another Unturned server tutorial. Now today we're going to be talking about installing a couple different plugins. The first one being the Death Messages plugin. If you guys...
Our technologies kind of automate us. We react. We're kind of all plugged in, you know, to our devices. And I'm really interested now in these automated services where you can announce your own death. Part of the tradition around the ethics of death is that we don't speak for our own death. We don't announce our own death. It's the task of other people to do that on our behalf. And the idea that we now have the opportunity through technology to set up our own automated death notices, I find very troubling, because it seems to me that that difficult conversation is then appropriated by a subject who is in fact dead when the announcement is being made, which was recorded when they were alive. So I think there's all these really interesting reversals around time that are taking place, and the appropriation of forms of cultural practice around death by ourselves, because we're in such an individualized, controlling, self-controlling society. There's a company called Eternity Message where it encourages people to set up for their children when they're babies email accounts where they will write to them. Keep writing and writing over the years letters to them and set up this whole repository of a conversation that they've constructed that will then be handed over, you know, and be posthumously given to the child upon your death. And I find this kind of posthumous parenting and posthumous relationship quite disturbing, because part of what is encouraged is that you are still in your child's relationship after you have died, and in some sense potentially influencing and directing their life and making certain assumptions about who they are and how they might be living their life. And I think that's a very oppressive thing to do. And this kind of extension of our lives beyond our biological existence is very selfish, really. And it's very self-aggrandizing. And I think technologies are allowing us to be incredibly egocentric about how important we are after we've died.
This is Future Tense, broadcast on RN in Australia, CBC in Canada, and RTE in Ireland, and available almost anywhere as a podcast. If you like the show and there's an opportunity to review us online, please don't be shy. It's a good way of letting other people know what we have to offer. I'm Anthony Fennell. Today, death, memory, and witnessing. And now let's go back several months to the Siege of Aleppo in Syria.
The Syrian government now has full control over Aleppo after the rebels retreated from the front line. People took to social media to post farewell messages in the final hours of the siege.
To everyone who can hear me, this may be my last video. More than 50,000 of civilians who rebelled against the dictator...
We may not be able to send any more messages as regime forces push closer and closer. The airstrikes become more intense.
One father in the city wrote, "Guess it's goodbye. Thanks all who stand for us and pray for us. But it's almost over."
Witnessing is the term that's now being used by researchers to describe situations where people use their smartphones to record or document a tragedy, including their own imminent demise. Amanda Howell is a researcher who focuses on the representation of death in war. How does she view what happened in Aleppo?
It's really offering an alternative representation of the victims of war. The images of the victims of war can be quite politically powerful, but the victims of war often themselves are also radically disempowered by those images, by the way that they're portrayed. Images of, you know, the victims of war can expose the ruthlessness of war, the evil of war, but as for the victims themselves, they're often silenced in all kinds of ways, even if they're still alive at the time of being photographed. I'm thinking right now of, you know, the notorious portraits by Khmer Rouge or the Nazis of their victims while they were still alive. What we have here is a representation, a self-representation of the victims of war that refuses to be just an object or to be silenced, that speaks for itself as something other than collateral damage. And although the messages refer to getting help and getting assistance, it's very clear that they don't expect help or assistance at this point. They know that they're going to die. And what they're doing is making a connection. And they're individuating themselves. They're reminding us of their connections to their loved ones, and they're establishing a connection to us as witnesses, not just as people who are seeing the war dead or seeing victims of war, but really working to establish a connection with us that carries with it a kind of ethical demand on those of us who hear and those of us who see.
What are the ethical considerations in terms of the way we deal with this material?
It's one of those places where the line between news and entertainment, which is very fine and very blurry, becomes especially problematic. The thought that this might lead to political action, that it might make some kind of political change, is very invigorating. The thought that these people's last words just become entertainment or clickbait is distressing and...
Because we're talking about voyeurism, basically.
Oh, yes. Where the witness becomes just an onlooker, as opposed to someone who feels a responsibility or feels a connection. I mean, that's the difference. And it's really in how they're perceived and how they're used, I think.
Get the female passenger out!
Ma'am, exit the car right now with your hands up! Let me see your hands! Exit now!
Another quite shocking but powerful example of witnessing took place last year in the United States.
He had a firearm and he was reaching for his wallet, and the officer just shot him in his arm. He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand out.
Diamond Reynolds, a young African-American woman, used her smartphone to live stream an encounter with a Minnesota police officer who had just fired four bullets into her boyfriend.
Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot four bullets.
What I find interesting about the way that social media is being used, has been used in the case of these police killings in the U.S., is that we've got African-American men who are being racially profiled, who are being stereotyped as being a priori criminals, and as a consequence, are not really allowed to speak for themselves. You look at the videos of these encounters, whether it's Philando Castile or Eric Garner, they're not being listened to by the police because they're already assumed to be criminals. So I see people like Diamond Reynolds and the person who recorded the attack on Eric Garner as intervening, not just in recording these things, but actually advocating for people who are not being heard and not being seen clearly.
And that's quite significant, isn't it? This isn't just a neutral piece of footage of a terrible incident.
No.
It is somebody in that very moment deciding to make a statement about what is going on, about the broader context that surrounds the images that people are seeing.
Yes, and offering an alternative narrative, speaking to the public. And we have a new connection with people in terrible circumstances who are breathing life into conflicts that otherwise we would just read about and possibly dismiss. You know, another war, another bombing, another civil conflict.
Dr. Amanda Howell from Griffith University. In 2014, that immediacy and the potential for a new form of connection provided by social media once again came to the fore when a passenger ferry sank off the coast of South Korea.
As desperate passengers are throwing themselves from the sinking ferry, a small blue boat...
More than 300 passengers and crew died, and many of them took photos and videos of themselves as the ship went down. Professor Larissa Horth from RMIT University.
Well, I mean, this is the really interesting thing about the event is the way that the selfie, you know, it amplifies the local, but it also amplifies the subject. And so you could actually see some people who were mocking the incident because they thought that they were going to survive. And so they're kind of doing the peace fingers, you know, all that kind of selfie performativity, while in the background you've got, you know, kind of people crying. And then you had some people who were actually using, they were talking into the mobile phone as if it was their parents or family and actually basically saying a kind of the last kind of, you know, I love you, I'll miss you, all these kind of things. So it was really, you know, in terms of seeing the textures of the selfie as a way of amplifying somebody's recognition of the event, it really covered a lot of breadth. You know, those that misunderstood and misrecognized the situation that they would survive and those that actually had, you know, kind of perception of actually being able to see their fate.
Now, those images, those bits of video were very powerful, were very affecting at the time.
Yes.
Tell us, though, about the relationship between the mourned and the mourner post those images, post that incident.
So one of the kind of really interesting things is that, you know, in terms of these kind of, you know, selfies being left for the families is that, you know, they did become vehicles for the eulogies and they did also become this kind of co-present moment in which the family could actually kind of be there almost as the child is going through that those kind of processes. So it creates a really kind of interesting relationship between, you know, that kind of liminal space of death, which usually death is, it's quite a private activity, you know, that kind of happens. And so through this kind of event, we see the selfie being, you know, perhaps talking about some kind of future trends in the way in which mobile media will be used by individuals to kind of leave those traces or spectres for family and for loved ones and also for the public in general. Because in this case, in the ferry disaster, it was through these very evocative images, these effective witnessing that really mobilised the public to kind of take revenge.
So is it right to say that these images heightened the sense of grief or the intimacy of the sense of grief that the, you know, the parents and relatives of the children experienced?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, they really did amplify a sense of intimate publics. And there's a concept in Korean called jong, which is kind of like intimacy, but it actually doesn't, there's no English word that translates closely, but it's the thing that binds Korean people to each other. And what happened afterwards and the way in which publics kind of really did, they were intimate publics, they were kind of about individual and familial loss, but it was really able to be then mobilised into a very kind of public action.
In one sense, you could imagine that a person who was grieving because of this accident might feel that they've been invited into the actual death of their relative or loved one. But in a sense, there's still a barrier there, isn't it? This may feel like a very intimate connection. But for those people witnessing this, there was nothing they could do.
Exactly. So, I mean, and this is the public narrative afterwards, I think that that kind of helplessness then became anger. It, you know, translated into anger. But I think, you know, one of the things to also to think about in the Korean context is Korea has one of the longest selfie cultures. So I was living in Korea over 10 years ago, and they have what they called selkra culture, which is selfie. And it was very much of young women did it. And unlike in a Western context where, you know, there's been a lot of debates about, you know, selfie as, you know, a vehicle for narcissism and all this kind of stuff, it was actually a vehicle for intimacy. So it was actually, you know, you take a picture to share with your friend that you wished was there and things like that. So it was always about the friendships and the intimacies rather than about the individual.
Now, some people might see the sharing of that kind of material, the intimacy of somebody's death, as morbid.
Yes, well, life is a bit morbid sometimes, you know. I mean, the reality is that with things like mobile media and, you know, like think about live Facebook, you can be on Facebook 1 minute and then suddenly a very graphic, traumatic event is being posted. And I think this is both the strength and weakness of mobile media. It allows us to have a very close relationship to death and trauma, and it allows it to be kind of, you know, enveloped within the fabric of our life. So I think it perhaps allows for a more healthy relationship to death and grieving than, say, the previous kind of historical models in Western culture.
Well, the thing about live streaming is that we're aware that something is unfolding here and now. You know, there's some imminent danger or there is imminent death on the horizon and there's not much time. And so we're in this kind of temporality of urgency. And yet, the response to that is always going to be delayed. There is no one that is going to come in and save those people. And so the inevitability of the fatality that is unfolding, I think, makes us feel very complicated about that, because we're sort of brought into this space in which we're very passive about how we can react to that. It's always going to be after the fact. And then what's our responsibility after the fact? And who's responsible for that live streaming and its impact in the political sphere? How is it going to organise justice or citizens reacting to that and trying to sort of bring about some kind of change or intervention or prevention of that happening again? So the kind of passivity that we can feel around that, I think, is quite troubling, because we can't act in time. And yet it feels as if we're in the time of something that is now happening. But we're not really in that time in any kind of way in which there is real agency attached to that. I think that passivity makes us concerned about the nature of our own witnessing. What is our position in relation to this unfolding image or these voices of desperation? Does that just make us voyeurs? You know, are we just in that typical position of being spectators to other people's pain? So we have to work out what we are going to do with our witnessing, if we are going to do anything. And what are we prepared to bear witness to? You know, there's ethical questions around what is streamed live now. You know, if someone is going to stream live their suicide, which certainly does happen, then it's very concerning that people would be spectators and voyeurs in that unfolding tragedy and not intervene in that event or try to get it shut down. But I think it's very difficult to stop some of this stuff and to shut it down. And it's always catch up, isn't it? It's always catch up to try and stop videos from living on, you know, and being accessed afterwards. Because it is unethical, I think, to watch somebody suicide, even if they have themselves have decided to make it a public act in some way.
Dr. Margaret Gibson from Griffith University in Brisbane. And before her, Professor Larissa Horth from RMIT in Melbourne. And Larissa, by the way, has a book coming out mid-year on mobile media, grief and loss. It's to be called Haunting Hands and will be published by Oxford University Press. Thanks as always to Karin Savanovitz and Steve Fieldhouse, my colleagues here at Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers.
This Is About is a podcast hosted by Jordan Raskopoulos. That's me. Stories told by those who live them.
To do a good job, you kind of have to believe that you're Spider-Man.
He was holding what he claimed was Ned Kelly's skull.
She just said to me, if you can't have this baby, I'll have a baby for you.
What I thought was two different dolphins was just one shark.
What? This Is About on the ABC Radio app or wherever you get your favourite podcasts.
Listen now.
On your phone.
You know, just do the thumb thing.